Welcome to the Uninvested Podcast, where we share the journeys of bold founders who are reshaping industries. If you enjoy this episode, like, comment, and share to help us bring more incredible stories to light. Today, we're joined by Dominic Montague, founder of Dirty Water, a hard seltzer brand making waves in New York City. With a background of gaming as VP of Game Operations at Roarify and a content creator of nearly 200,000 TikTok followers, Dominic launched Dirty Water in May 2004 to shake up the seltzer scene. Let's dive into Dominic's journey together. Dom, to jump in here, how do you enter the alcohol market industry?
I'll say it's definitely tougher than I expected, especially someone coming from not a CPG or alcohol space. Previously, I was in tech, mobile gaming, and even before that, I was in fashion. So I would say it was a mix of just Googling a lot of like, you know, what I needed to do. So like, I think there's two parts of it, right? One is kind of creating a CPG product, and the other is the alcohol industry itself, with like, which has tons of red tape and regulations. That stuff, it's kind of easy to discover what you need. Talking with alcohol attorneys and, you know, people who are more knowledgeable within the space to know the do's and don'ts of the alcohol industry itself. And then outside of that, yeah, just understanding what it takes to get a CPG product from inception to shelf stable, and then eventually like on the shelves. That was, I would say, like the tougher part. There's not many resources, at least like from what I found, just like Googling of like, oh, how do I get a product made, right? Like there's a lot of people who say they started with batching and brewing and kind of coming up with flavors in their kitchen. I didn't go down that route because I knew eventually I'd have to make a shelf stable product. So I kind of went the route of just working with what they call like a flavor house. Off the bat, which is basically a food scientist that you give them a brief and saying exactly what you want, and you do sample rounds back and forth with them to eventually get the product that you want. So that was the first step, and that was actually really tough to find and even discover that I needed that step in general. And then after that, then there's like all these other arduous steps between that and then, especially with alcohol, then finally getting it into the consumer's hands.
Yeah, you didn't just enter any industry. You entered probably one of the most saturated markets in the world. So how do you stand out against the big guys, you know, against White Claw, Truly, you know, that are funded up to the teeth?
So it's funny. I think with hard seltzer, and the way I describe the hard seltzer market, I don't necessarily call it saturated. I call it definitely mature, especially at this point, right? I think there was that period between like, you know, I discovered White Claw 2018, and that's when I discovered hard seltzer in general. And then obviously there was this COVID sort of hard seltzer boom where like everybody was making hard seltzers, right? Like every brand under the sun, whether it's like Sonic, Sunny D, like Mountain Dew, they were all like just making a hard seltzer, even if it was a brand that did not align with, you know, the seltzer market. And then eventually in 2024, a lot of those brands that came in trying to capitalize on the market, they have fallen off to the wayside because, you know, people are drinking at least what I consider like just the better of the products rather than just trying anything, right? And so I think with that said, my approach to coming into the hard seltzer market was a little bit different, right? So if you look at the hard seltzer space in general, you have, again, your White Claws, High Noons, Trulies, and all these big players. And they're all, in my opinion, kind of doing a very similar thing. They're aiming at fruity flavors and a variety of fruity flavors, right? So a ton of SKUs, and they aim a little bit more upstream, right? So White Claw started, and then High Noon's a little bit more of a premium product. So they aim at a premier price point. And they have just a lot of flavors. Sometimes they have unique flavors. Sometimes, you know, they all have like their black cherry. And so my approach was a little bit different because outside of hard seltzers, my favorite beverages traditionally were like your light swelly beers. So like your PBRs, High Life, Bud Light, Modelo, you know, beers that you could drink with anything because they're so light in flavor, but the main flavor, main experience you're getting is light, crisp, and refreshing, right? And so I wanted that experience in the form of a hard seltzer because hard seltzers are just generally more healthy, right? Lower carb, lower sugar, gluten-free, lower calorie. And so I thought, you know, rather than going these tart and candy sweet flavors, why can't we just have a more simple single flavor experience that is more adjacent to beer? And so that's sort of the way that I'm pushing it and, you know, marketing it. So I'm very much focused on the bar scene where you do drink a lot of these
light beers.
How much of it is balancing marketing? You know, Dirty Water is the name of the brand, kind of reminds me of Liquid Death versus kind of what you're alluding to, building very quality product.
The building the product itself, I think the way that I would look at it is starting with square one, which is before any marketing and before any sales, it was really just finding that product to go to market with. I'm actually still iterating on it because I think you can always improve on the product. But for me, the premise was always the same, regardless if the flavor changes completely or gets tweaked over time. The premise is always a single flavor, light, sessionable hard seltzer. And so starting with that as the sort of brief, working backwards, finding the flavor that ended up working, at least currently for the time being, right? That took about a year of formulation. And then from there, then, you know, another year of development, and then finally going to market, you know, after that second year. So getting that quality product is there, which is nice. I will be working on other, I would say like diffusion lines that aren't necessarily a second flavor, but we could talk about that a little bit later. But I would say the real balance for me right now is balancing between brand building and marketing or actual boots on the ground sales, right? And they're both, it's sort of that chicken and the egg problem, right? Where it's, you know, if you only focus on sales, right, then will people who go into these locations, whether it's a grocery store or a bar, will they even recognize the product? Will they want to buy the product, or will just sit on shelves? In which case, it's a really bad experience for both me as the business owner, as well as the other business owner, which is the retail or bar location that's carrying it, right? Because they don't want product sitting there, then it leaves a bad taste in their mouth, and, you know, it's not a good relationship. Or do I focus completely on brand building and marketing, in which case, you know, I'm building this vision, I'm building this world of Dirty Water, but as a consumer, if they don't see it anywhere, then the marketing dollars are just going to waste, right? And so it really is choosing and, you know, honing in on what I should be focusing on now, which is actually, you know, I would say my biggest struggle currently is, you know, choosing what path I should go down or where I should focus more of my time. Hiring on salespeople is obviously one, I'm not going to say band-aid solution, but that is a scalable solution. But that is, especially when coming from founder-led sales to now building up a sales team, there is growing pains, right? Because founder-led sales is, in my opinion, more effectively easy, especially with like a homegrown brand trying to, you know, build in your backyard. I get to go to places and say, hey, I'm the founder. Do you want to give me a shot? But once you have a sales team, now there's this sort of perception, right? That as a salesperson, it's like, oh, this is just a salesperson from the brand. What are they going to do for me? I don't want to help just another brand with, like, you know, an ambassador coming my way, right? And so it really is trying to build that story that's easy to sell, I would say. And that's kind of where, like, the branding and marketing ideally will come into play.
Bring me, you know, to all the way back to day one. You have this new seltzer, it looks great, Dirty Water. How did you get your first sale? How did you get your next 10 sales? And then how did you scale to 100? You know, bring me through, what were those tactics?
The way that I did my first sales was like, if you bring in my product, I guarantee people will buy it because I have a list of people who will buy it immediately when you bring it in. And so that kind of helped me secure my first sales. I even did a gambit where it's like, if people don't buy it, I'll buy it back. You know, like, so make it really like low risk on their end. Sometimes there's still that friction of like, I don't know, seems kind of fishy, right? So like, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work. But I would say for the most part, especially since it was like places that they've seen my face before, it was a little bit easy. But there's this one location, it's a little bit of a bigger grocery store. So the early bodegas were like pretty easy because I was like a regular to them. But when you look at these bigger grocery stores, they do have a lot of space, but the space, the way it works on their bar wall or their beer wall is every slot is owned by a big company already, or like it's owned by a distributor, right? And so I go in and I'm like, hey, I'm a local. I have my hard seltzer. I would love for you to carry it. I guarantee I will sell 5-10 cases the first week. You have my word, yada, yada. And then he shows me, he takes out the planogram and says, every single one of these spots are completely taken. He's like, even if I wanted to bring you in, I can't because this is owned by these guys, this is owned by these guys, this is owned by these guys, which again is a huge barrier to entry, as you mentioned, when it comes to alcohol, because I'm against so many big people and players. And so me being ignorant, I was like, okay, this is all taken. But in front of this refrigerator, which is like, so it's like an open concept fridge where, like, you know, there's no doors. I was like, but in front of the fridge, there's like free real estate. I'm like, what if I just put my product in front of it, right? And he was thinking about it, and he's like, yeah, I guess that could work. And I'm like, great. It doesn't need to be like completely cold in the wall. It could just be right there. Little to my knowledge, that apparently is the best spot in the house, because as soon as you turn into the aisle, it's the first thing you see is this stack of dirty water cases right front and center, like not hidden in the wall, not like blended in with anything. It's like literally the very first thing. And so me, I thought it was a compromise, but somehow I BD'd my way into the best spot in the house. So, you know, that was one of my very first sales that I was very proud of. From there, it was a lot of the same, I would say, going bar to bar. It really is just the most manual thing you could possibly do. Going bar to bar with cans of cold, dirty water, having people taste it, selling them the dream, telling them, you know, what my goals are, what I think this could do for the menu, and really kind of play into, you know, how it would fit within their bar's aesthetic as well as their program. As I mentioned, I am mainly focused on bars. Grocery stores are a plus, and I think you kind of need a balance of both. But as what I kind of cheekily call it, the dive bar hard seltzer, it really does live and breathe on bars, right? And like, I think being one of those things where you can get a dirty water and a shot combo, people really do like grasp onto that and really understand that premise of it. And so that's been easy to sell to the bars specifically, because bars buy very differently than the way that a grocery store would. A bar, you know, all the products they bring in, they want it to be cohesive. They want to be able to be behind it. They want to be able to recommend it, right? And so me being a product that a bartender can get behind was, I would say, like an easier sell.
So how'd you move past that? You know, first you sell to the bodegas, people that know you, but then you go to these places where you don't really have any credibility and you're walking in with this, you know, cases of cold seltzer. How do you convince them that, hey, this is a credible product, I'm a credible brand? And probably at the time, I imagine it's just yourself, maybe a few other people. So kind of how do you get by those, you know, barriers to entry? Like, they're like, will this be a business tomorrow type of thing?
I think I'm still in this really early stage where people do want to get behind the founder-led thing, right? And it's like, oh, this is a New York-based brand. I'm selling within New York. And so I think there is a bit of an easier sell. I think sometimes people think I'm crazy. Like, I go in and say, hey, I just started a hard seltzer. Would love to get my product in here. I love the bar. I think this could go really well. Sometimes they're like, yeah, it doesn't really fit our program. We don't want to carry another hard seltzer, XYZ, which, you know, you just at the end of the day have to respect. I know there are some other brands that are a bit more pushy, but that's because they have a lot more marketing dollars behind them. But, you know, I think for me, one of the big things is like really just following up, and just like any sort of sales process and sales funnel, the follow-up is what's key. Sometimes they say no day one, follow up, you know, go there, buy a drink, sit at the bar, chat with the bartenders, chat with the beverage directors, the managers on staff, you know, and kind of get to know them, eventually push dirty water. And so that's helped me a lot. But I think, again, it's easy now as I scale and as I have scaled out to salespeople and ambassadors, that's where I'm still sort of trying to figure out what the best way for them to sell is. Because, you know, they want to be effective. They're trying to hit quotas and goals and things like that. And so, like, you know, what's perceived as a waste of time versus perceived as, oh, this is making steps into the right direction. And, you know, I think it is a bit of art and science when it comes to selling. You really have to be a chameleon and kind of understand the environment the way it is there. Maybe it's just a bad day for the manager. So you're like, I'm not going to bother him right now. I'm going to come back on a good day, feel out the environment, because yeah, a bad day could be a no forever, and a good day could be it'll be an easy yes. So I would say that's been one of the biggest challenges. But now as I have continued to scale, and for me, since a lot of my day is not only just selling, but like account managing, which actually is much harder than the selling process, right? It's the follow-up, making sure they do repeat buys, because that's what tells the story. Getting into a bunch of locations is like the easy part, but getting these like handful of locations to purchase, not once a month, twice a month, once a week, right? That's what creates a compelling story for bigger distributors, investors, and things like that. So that's what I've been focusing on. And so currently I am leaning more towards account management, account growth, leaning on warm intros for my personal expansion of accounts. But I do have also like some salespeople that do more of the manual cold outreach.
Focusing on yourself, doing these founder-led sales, say follow, What do those follow-ups look like? You know, you don't want to be a cheesy salesman. You don't want to be, you know, like you're bugging the person constantly. You know, so I guess when do you think it's time to stop following up? What do your follow-ups look like?
I would say it really depends on, again, kind of getting a feel for the waters, right? How they perceived you originally. And then if you think that there is worth or is value in following up, right? If they said, oh, this is interesting. I'm not sure if I can take it right now, or I'm doing like a menu change in a couple weeks, couple months, go in every week, every other week, every few weeks, right? Making sure they remember your face, you know, spend that time with the team, not like, you know, in team meetings, but like going in, sitting at the bar, you know, being a casual, being a local. So like, it's funny, I say that my day job is drinking, but it's true because like I go in and, you know, I enjoy time with them, you know, whether it's like a beer and just like hanging out, snacking on some food too. So I would say that's been a lot of my follow-up. And then, you know, it's great if they are open to giving you their contact information, because then it makes things easy. It's like, hey, you know, when's the next time you're in? We'd love to stop by, chat some more. I have some ideas that I want to run by you. I think that's the best thing, because like follow-up that's just empty and shallow and saying, hey, I exist, like doesn't really help anybody. But if you follow up and say, hey, I had this idea, would love to run it by you, let me know what you think. Or even, hey, I'm testing this new flavor out. And by flavor, I mean, like, I do a lot of, like, cocktails and mix-ins with my dirty water. It's like, hey, when are you free next? I want you to try something. I think, like, you know, follow-ups with substance are obviously really meaningful. Yeah, just tossing ideas towards them and letting them be part of the conversation.
And I understand you've been leading into being a creator as well to really push your brand. So how are you going about balancing that? And what kind of led to that decision, right? Because at the end of the day, well, you are tied in selling to consumers, it sounds a lot like what you're doing is B2B sales. So then, do you find success being a creator in that aspect?
Being a creator is actually pretty interesting. And I think maybe my approach to how I built my personal content creation brand may not have been perfect for translating one-to-one from those consumers to consumers of dirty water. But I think I'm starting to refine that. But to answer your question, the way I started with my content creation. So I have a TikTok account with, I think almost close to 200,000 followers now, mainly food content. And so I incorporated Dirty Water in, I think, April or May of 2022. That following September, I started a TikTok account. And the idea was I'll make a personal TikTok. And if this happens to blow up, because TikTok, you know, it's very, or anything social, like, you know, it's not guaranteed. If I happen to blow this up, then I will use this as a traction channel for Dirty Water, which, you know, is a great organic traction channel. And also being a content creator, you do get some money, which is nice, helps pay some of the bills. I was posting a video a day, at least one video a day for like 2 years, about two years. And then as soon as I launched Dirty Water, I actually stopped posting as often just because I ended up becoming so focused with the day-to-day that editing videos and even it's less of the editing videos, but more of the content creation. Because for me, my whole premise with Damrier, my TikTok account, was record videos of what I'm cooking for lunch or dinner or breakfast that day, and then just chop it up, and then I put it out there. But as I become more busy, I started making food less. And so just ordering food on, you know, one of the apps, that's always kind of like my go-to when I'm really busy. So with that, I have less content to put out.
What kind of led to that turning point then? Because you said you're posting every day for 2 years. Was like, did you see a bigger upswing when you started posting about a brand or being a founder? People kind of latched on to that, I guess? Or did you kind of pivot that aspect?
I would inject it sort of organically, talking about, hey, I'm like launching a brand. I'm doing XYZ. I would do like some of my taste tests. So like some of my early rounds on TikTok, which was really fun. A lot of my Dirty Water content was lower in view counts than some of my bigger videos. I mean, granted, like my TikTok views are sort of like all over the place, but some of my Dirty Water stuff has done like worse than some of my like best stuff.
Do you lean really heavily on it because, you know, you bootstrapped for a long time and it was like a very cheap channel? Or was it, do you think even if you had raised millions and millions of dollars, that would probably be one of your best channels?
Regardless of you know, how much money I have raised, right? I think the nice thing with social is like founder communication is really good for like an early brand, right? I think it creates this level of humanity for a brand that, you know, many people like don't have. Even like, so for example, Tom Holland just launched a beer brand, right? Or a non-alc beer brand. And like even him, who has all the resources in the world, he's still, as you know, going out as one of the founder-led people, doing the sales, doing the talk shows, talking about the brand. So I think, you know, regardless whether the like what the brand is nowadays, especially in this sort of climate, people love to understand what the brand's about rather than just like blindly buying into something that was built in a machine.
I guess, what do you think about like the vision? You always talk about your brand. Like when you came into this, what was like your exit, right? Was it like, you know, if someone were to buy me out, because I imagine, you know, if you have a very popular brand, a big company might want to buy you out, make you like a subsidiary under them. Was that a route you see it? Like when you started it, what was your end game?
It's a great question. So I would say, you know, when thinking about starting this product in general, people ask me like, you know, am I profitable XYZ? And I always just tell them, listen, if I wanted to make a ton of money really fast, I would not be doing this, right? I would still be in mobile gaming, making hand over fist compared to like anything that's CPG, especially alcohol related, right? So for me, this really was something that I started for passion, right? Like I think the thing that I love, whether it's cooking or whether it's someone trying something of this or trying like a recommendation or something I have, right? Is there instant reaction, that instant gratification for me of seeing if they enjoy it or not, right? And so that's something that I really latched onto. Dirty Water is a product that I do really believe in. And again, it is because of the vision of it, right? Being this single flavor, sessionable, light beverage that is a nice beer alternative. Sometimes I say it's like, you know, what's my best case scenario with this? Well, even from like day one. So for example, if someone said, hey, do you want to build this brand underneath us? You just get a few points of equity, you get a salary and you get unlimited resources. I probably would have taken that deal because for me, it's like the things I love are just building, right? I don't care how I'm building, who I'm building for. If I have the means and the ability to make, you know, my own decisions, work autonomously, and work to build something greater, then that's what I love doing. An exit, whether it's an acquisition, whether it's a partnership, whether it's, I think partnerships can come in many different ways. I think that is pretty realistic when it comes to, you know, the end goal here. Acquisitions in this space are becoming a bit tighter just because of the, you know, people are just acquiring less companies right now. But, you know, I wouldn't shy away from an acquisition. I wouldn't shy away from just building this myself until, you know, it becomes its own like living, breathing company.
When you're thinking about moving in, you mentioned like partnerships and such like that. What do you mean they can come in multiple forms?
For example, a partnership could be minority stake and they give you X amount of resources to do whatever it is, or partner with a bigger distributor in a different type of capacity. So, you know, especially alcohol, it gets very tricky because when it comes to equity investment and equity ownership, there's the thing called tied house laws and part of this, what they call a three-tier system. And so a three-tier system is post-prohibition. It's the system that says you as a creator or an alcohol brand needs to be three layers of touch points before the end consumer, right? So it's manufacturing, distribution, and then retail and then the consumer, right? You cannot have ownership in more than one of these verticals. So as a distributor or a retailer, say you own like even a grocery store and a company was raising money and you're like, oh, I love this company. You are not allowed to invest in that because you are a point of distribution for that product, which means that you could effectively corner your market and say, oh, now my bodega only sells that product, right? And so like that makes it very tough for like certain types of partnerships. Because like, you know, in a great scenario, it's like, hey, as a distributor, do you want to partner in my brand, have equity stake, and then, you know, you can do whatever with it and we can grow it together. For example, like Live Nation has a stake in Liquid Death, right? And they can do that because it's non-alcohol. They could not do that with an alcohol brand, but that's why you see a lot of Live Nation venues and events. Liquid Death is the premier water at those locations. That is illegal in this case of alcohol.
You as a founder, how do you stay so zeroed in on Dirty Water when you have so much competition out there? And there's also this, you know, non-direct competition of people drinking alcohol less. You know, Tom Holland, like you mentioned, he's launching an alcohol-free beverage. So how do you stay zeroed in and kind of, you know, push out the competition? Or do you kind of keep an eye on it?
Definitely keep an eye on what people are doing. I think if you, especially with alcohol and things that take a little bit of a longer lead time, it's tougher to pivot, right? So you really have to be honed in. And that's why, you know, I tell people, yeah, I had this idea since 2018. And they were like, oh, it would have been great if you made it then, right? You would have been, you would have been like, you know, a leader and had like all this money. I'm like, yes, but I did not make it then because I discovered White Claw and I discovered that's what I thought I was missing at the time. And so I was like, oh, I don't need anything else. And so, you know, the market grew again. And then 2022, I was like, I had all these delicious hard seltzers. I've had some bad hard seltzers, but still no one's doing what I'm doing. Right. And I found after all this time, 4 years of not acting on my vision, that it's still the right vision to go about. And so, you know, with that amount of time, I knew that this is something special. And that's why I think I can kind of stay zeroed in without kind of bringing in some of the noise, right? I will say that I am working on a second product offering that is a little bit more, I guess, trendy right now. So I'm working on a non-alcohol THC Delta 9 version of Dirty Water, which Delta 9 beverages, which are hemp-derived beverages, are very, very popular right now in the D2C space, as well as off-premise sales, which is like just like retail locations. So I am making a Delta 9 version of Dirty Water, which is actually the same exact premise of a single flavor, lightened flavor, sessionable beverage. And with that's going to be a little bit of a lower dosage potency. And so that, you could say, I guess, is a bit of more of chasing the trends.
Do you think it's problematic to chase after trends? I mean, clearly not, because you're doing it. But I guess, what are the benefits and not benefits to, you know, riding a wave that a lot of people are?
You know, being early in, and the definition of early, I think, is the biggest thing when it comes to trends. Like, if you think this thing's going to be, you know, hit and quit within like 1 year, is it worth jumping on? Probably not, right? But if it's something that, especially for my example, this diffusion product of this Delta 9 product is, yes, it is trendy, right? But I do think that the products of these Delta 9 THC brands will be here to stay. And I think just having an anchor of Dirty Water Hard Seltzer as the main beverage and this being the other alternative, I think that's what allows me to be able to kind of create the second one, because it's not, it doesn't go against the grain, right? It doesn't feel shoehorned into the bigger vision of what Dirty Water is. It feels kind of right in place. So I think if I was like, if I was to make like a gummy, for example, like an edible gummy, I think that would be a little bit like different. But because it is like a second beverage with the same exact philosophy, just with a different emulsion, you know, makeup of liquid, I think that's what allows it to kind of fit hand in hand. And so I think it is more time and place, and it just happens to be trendy at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. So I asked one last question to all my guests, but has there been any routine that you've maintained throughout the years?
So I would say the one routine that I still go by, and actually I was talking with a very seasoned and I would say like wealthy, to say the least, an investor, not my investor, just a general investor. So I've been running every day for the past, since like the start of COVID. I ran high school and college, stopped running for a long time, picked it back up during COVID. And I run pretty much every day. I would say that's one of the main routines that I keep. And in the words of my investor friend, he says, make things that are non-negotiable, right? And for me, the running is non-negotiable. Because I find that as a solo founder, it could be depressing sometimes. But I've heard and I truly believe that working out and self-care is the best antidepressant you could have. So me working out every morning, running every morning is a routine that I definitely will live by.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Sometimes as a founder, it's like chewing glass. So you need to break out of that mold sometimes. But with that, Dom, thank you so much for coming on. I'm Sahil.
I'm Dal. And thanks for having me.
And this has been Uninvested. Thank you.
This is a personal video. Any views or opinions represented in this video are personal and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations we may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity. The views expressed are for entertainment purposes only and not to be misinterpreted as actionable investment advice.